So to start off today, I want you to imagine that you are hiking through this incredibly dense, lush mountain forest.
Oh, sounds nice.
Right. It's beautiful. You step over a mossy log, you look down at the damp earth, and you spot this small, dark amphibian. It's a Caucasian salamander.
Okay, a salamander, very specific.
Yeah, and it looks ordinary enough, but there is a massive catch.
Which is.
Well, by all the laws of planetary climate history, this creature, and honestly the entire forest you are walking through, should have been completely wiped off the face of the earth.
Ah, right. Wiped out by a mile-thick sheet of ice.
Exactly, hundreds of thousands of years ago, yet here it is, just thriving. So welcome to the deep dive. Today we are exploring this absolute geographic fortress that makes anomalies like that possible.
It is a truly wild region.
It really is. We have a massive stack of sources today: encyclopedia entries, historical records, ecological surveys, all covering the Caucasus. It's a region that basically bisects Eastern Europe and Western Asia.
And for our mission today, we are trying to figure out how this one specific mountain range acts as Eurasia's ultimate vault.
Okay, let's unpack this. We are looking at a place that has physically trapped and preserved, well, ancient human ancestors, completely isolated linguists.
Mirrored mythologies, too.
Right. And even, like you said, prehistoric ecosystems.
Is the ultimate vault because it is quite literally a massive natural wall.
Yeah.
I mean, geographically, the region is dominated by the greater and lesser Caucasus mountain
And they
ranges.
stretch directly between two seas, right?
Yeah, exactly. From the Black Sea on the west, straight across to the Caspian Sea on the east. And to really grasp the sheer vertical scale we are talking about here, you just have to look at Mount Elbrus.
Oh, Mount Elbrus is just staggering.
It really is. It sits near the modern Russian-Georgian border, and at 5,642 meters, it is the highest peak in Europe.
Wow, so it completely dwarfs the Alps.
Oh, easily. It is this towering, dormant volcano, just entirely encased in glaciers.
And it's so imposing that even the very names given to it by early peoples tell you exactly how hostile this environment was.
The etymology is fascinating.
Right. Like Pliny the Elder, the Roman author, he noted that the name derives from a Scythian word meaning shimmering with snow.
And you have to remember who the Scythians were.
Yeah, they were these hardened, nomadic, horseback warriors of the Eurasian steppe. So if a mountain range makes them stop and say, "Wow, look at all that ice," you know it's a formidable barrier.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then you also have a Latvian root word that translates the concept to frozen mud.
Frozen mud, just so bleak.
It is. You get this immediate picture of this beautiful, but just almost impassable frozen frontier.
Impassable is a great word for it. It kind of makes me think of ancient map makers, you know? Like when they reached the edge of the known world, they would just draw sea monsters. How did ancient people make sense of this massive icy wall?
Well, when ancient civilizations encountered an impassable physical barrier like that, they didn't just map it, they mythologized it.
Of course.
Because human psychology kind of dictates that whatever we cannot conquer, we weave into our cosmology. So for the ancient Greeks navigating the eastern edges of the Black Sea, the Caucasus Mountains literally looked like a wall holding up the sky.
So it became exactly that in their stories.
Right. It became one of the pillars supporting the world. It was the absolute edge of human reality for them.
And because it was so remote and terrifying, wasn't this the exact location where Zeus chained the Titan Prometheus?
Yes. Chained him to a rock and left an eagle to eat his liver every single day.
Brutal. And all as punishment for giving humanity the secret of fire.
It's a heavy myth. But it wasn't just the Greeks projecting their fears onto this wall. The Persian empires to the south did the exact same thing.
With Mount Kaf, right.
Exactly. In Persian lore, this region is tied to Mount Kaf. It's this legendary, mysterious peak that supposedly surrounds the entire known world.
Basically, the boundary line between the realm of humans and the realm of the totally unknown.
Yep. But the dynamic here is much more complex than just outside empires looking at the mountains and telling stories about them.
Because the people living inside the mountains had their own stories.
Exactly. When you look at the highly localized folklore of the people who actually lived inside the Caucasus, specifically these oral traditions known as the Nart sagas, the parallels to outside mythology are just staggering.
The Nart sagas are wild. They chronicle this ancient race of heroes, And one of the central figures is this shape-shifting trickster named Sosrequo.
Sosrequo, right.
And according to the legend, he was born burning in flames, so a blacksmith god had to dip him in magic water to make his body invulnerable to weapons.
But there's a catch.
There's always a catch. To dip him, the god had to hold him by the knees with a pair of tongs. So Sosrequo is completely invincible except for that one tiny spot where the tongs gripped his legs.
I mean, he is essentially the Greek hero Achilles.
Exactly, right down to the fatal weakness in the lower leg.
And the crossover doesn't stop there. There are specific Georgian folktales about two brothers who were taken prisoner by a massive one-eyed giant who herds sheep.
Okay, I think I know where this is going.
Right. So to escape, the brothers heat up a spit in the fire, stab the giant in his single eye, and flee.
If you have ever read Homer's Odyssey, that is practically a carbon copy of Odysseus escaping the Cyclops, Polyphemus.
It is nearly identical.
Okay, wait. I have to push back here. Here's where it gets really interesting. Because Jason and the Argonauts sailing to Colchis, Odysseus fighting the Cyclops, Achilles and his heel, these are like the foundational texts of Western civilization.
They absolutely are.
So are we saying the Greeks imported the core of their heroic mythology from a Georgian mountain valley? Or did the Greeks just, I don't know, force their stories onto the mountain tribes?
It's a fantastic question. And it really speaks to the mechanics of ancient trade.
How so?
Well, we tend to think of the ancient world as super disconnected. But the Black Sea was actually an incredibly active maritime highway.
Oh, right. Lots of ships going back and forth.
Exactly. Greek sailors and merchants were constantly interacting with the coastal peoples of the Caucasus. What we are likely seeing isn't a one-way street of copying, but a cultural feedback loop.
A feedback loop. So like a Greek sailor trades some bronze goods for Caucasian gold or timber.
They sit around a fire at night.
And they just swap stories.
Exactly. They swap stories about giants and invincible warriors. And over centuries, those stories blend together. The mountains were a wall, yes. But the valleys that opened up to the sea acted as this amazing mixing bowl for the people who managed to navigate them.
Wow. And that mixing bowl effect wasn't just catching ancient sailors. Because long before the Greeks or Persians even existed, this physical barrier captured the earliest known human ancestors.
Yes, the literal vault of human history.
We have to talk about the Dimanisi archaeological site in Georgia because the numbers here are almost hard to comprehend.
They really are. Back in the early 1990s, archaeologists at Dimanisi uncovered hominin fossils, specifically a subspecies classified as Homo erectus georgicus.
And how old are these?
These fossils date back 1.8 million years.
1.8 million years. I mean, to put that in perspective for you, the listener, modern Homo sapiens, our species, we have only been around for roughly 300,000 years.
It's a massive time gap.
It is.
Yeah.
So what were these early hominins doing all the way up in the Caucasus?
They were migrating.
Yeah.
I mean, these are the five oldest unequivocal hominin skulls ever found anywhere outside of the African continent.
Wow. Anywhere?
Yes. For a long time, we really didn't fully understand how or when early humans moved into Eurasia. But the Dimanisi find provides the mechanism.
So the mountains guided them.
Exactly. As these early populations moved north out of the Levant, the massive physical barrier of the Caucasus acted as a geographic funnel. It essentially guided them into these specific, highly hospitable valleys.
And what absolutely blows my mind is that this geographic funnel, this vault, it just kept doing its job for the next 2 million years.
Never stopped.
If you look at the demographic map of the region today, it is arguably the most complex tapestry of human diversity on the entire planet.
Oh, without a doubt. There are more than 50 distinct ethnic groups living in the Caucasus today.
And the languages. We aren't just talking about slightly different dialects of the same root language here.
No, not at all.
The sources highlight no fewer than 3 entirely unique language families indigenous strictly to this area. You have the Kartvelian, the Northwest Caucasian, and the Northeast Caucasian families, all just existing right alongside Indo-European and Turkic languages.
What's fascinating here is the underlying mechanism of that diversity.
Yeah.
I mean, why are there 3 completely unique language families here when entire continents are often dominated by just 1 or 2?
Right, like how Indo-European just blanketed Europe.
Exactly. It all comes down to the friction of the terrain. Consider how linguistic homogenization usually happens. An empire with a strong military rolls across a flat steppe or a river valley. They conquer the inhabitants, and they enforce a single language and legal code.
But you can't exactly just roll a chariot or a tank column across the greater Caucasus.
Precisely. The valleys are so deep, The ridges are so jagged, and the winters are so severe, that human populations became hyper-isolated.
So they were just cut off?
Completely. A group of people could live in one valley for 5,000 years, developing their own entirely unique language and culture, completely cut off from another group living just, say, 20 miles away on the other side of a ridge.
That is wild. It's almost like a massive acoustic foam room.
Ooh, I like that comparison.
You know how sound studios have those deep, jagged foam wedges on the walls?
Yeah, to kill the echoes.
Right, they trap the sound waves so they don't bounce around and muddy the audio. The Caucasus is basically a geographic acoustic foam room.
That's a great way to put it.
Tribes, languages, and cultures enter, but instead of blending together into one giant unified noise or empire, they get trapped in these separate, deep mountain pockets. They just survive, perfectly intact, side by side, for millennia.
That acoustic foam effect is brilliant for preserving human heritage. But if we connect this to the bigger geopolitical picture, that exact same isolation is a tragic double-edged sword.
Because they can't unite.
Partly, yes. When a valley allows a population to develop a fiercely independent, highly localized identity over thousands of years, they become incredibly resistant to outside assimilation.
Which makes them a target.
Exactly. And if that valley happens to sit squarely on the most strategically vital real estate in Eurasia, that localized independence puts a massive target on their backs.
Which explains why this vault inevitably became one of the bloodiest battlegrounds in human history. Huh. To really understand why empires cared so much about these mountains, you just have to look at the map.
Geography is destiny.
It is. The Caucasus is the only land bridge between the Black and Caspian Seas.
Right.
If you are an empire to the north, like Russia, and you want access to the warm water ports and trade routes of the Middle East, you have to go through the Caucasus.
And the reverse is true.
Right. If you are an empire to the south, like the Persians or the Ottomans, and you want to push into Europe or the Eurasian steppe, you have to go through the Caucasus.
It is the ultimate geographic choke point. You cannot simply bypass it. You either control the mountain passes, like the famous Darial Gorge, or you leave the soft underbelly of your empire completely exposed to invasion.
So what does this all mean for the people actually living there? Because before we dive into the history here, I want to say to you, the listener, we are about to cover some intense and politically charged historical conflicts involving multiple nations and ideologies.
Very heavy history.
Yes. And our goal is absolutely not to take a side or endorse any specific viewpoint. We are purely here to share the factual historical record contained in our sources so you can understand the region's current complexities.
That's a very important distinction. Because of that brutal geographic calculus we mentioned, the region was subjected to a relentless conveyor belt of conquests.
Just one after another.
Oh, yeah. The Romans fought to set up provinces in western Georgia. Then came the Sassanids, the last major pre-Islamic Persian empire, who battled the Byzantines for control.
And then the Arabs arrived, right?
Yes. In the 7th century, Arab armies arrived, pushing through the passes and introducing Islam to the region. Later, the Ottoman Empire and various Turco-Mongol conquerors swept through. And then eventually you have the aggressive southern expansion of the Russian Empire in the 19th century.
Just looking at the historical record in our sources, the human cost of being a choke point is, well, it's just devastating.
It is truly heartbreaking.
We're looking at centuries of overlapping claims, shifting borders, and massive human tragedy. The geography protected these cultures, but it also trapped them in the crossfire of superpowers.
The 19th and 20th centuries were particularly catastrophic, as the Russian Empire sought to definitively secure its southern borders and control the Black Sea coast during the Caucasian Wars. The texts document the resulting ethnic cleansing of the indigenous Circassian population.
And that was a massive expulsion.
Huge. Hundreds of thousands of North Caucasian Muslims were systematically expelled from their ancestral valleys and forced to flee across the Black Sea as refugees into the Ottoman Empire. And there was massive loss of life along the way.
And the tragedies really just compounded as empires collapsed and reformed.
They did.
During World War I, the region became a primary theater for the horrors of the Armenian Genocide, where the Ottoman government systematically deported and killed massive numbers of Armenians.
A profound tragedy.
And that was immediately followed by the Turkish-Armenian War in 1920, resulting in the deaths of tens of thousands more Armenian civilians.
The vault provided no escape from the paranoid security apparatus of the Soviet Union either.
Right, Stalin's era.
Yes. In the 1940s, Joseph Stalin, who ironically enough was born in Georgia, right, within the Caucasus, he obsessively feared that the fiercely independent mountain populations would collaborate with invading German forces or threaten the Soviet border.
So what did he do?
The solution was a horrific feat of social engineering. Around 480,000 Chechens and Ingush, 120,000 Karachay Balkars, along with thousands of others, were just loaded onto trains and forcibly deported en masse.
Just ripped out of their valley.
Entirely. Sent to the frozen steppes of Central Asia and Siberia.
And our sources indicate that roughly a quarter of those deported died from starvation, disease, and exposure during the journey and the early years of exile.
It's hard to even process those numbers.
It is. It's a staggering logistical effort just to empty these valleys. And even after the Soviet Union dissolved in 1991, the pressure cooker didn't stop.
The lid came off, but the heat was still on.
Exactly. The sudden removal of Soviet control, combined with those ancient, distinct identities that were trapped in the acoustic foam of the valleys, it ignited a series of complex, modern territorial conflicts. You see it in Nagorno-Karabakh, Abkhazia, South Ossetia, and Chechnya.
It is the great tragic paradox of the region. The mountains are formidable enough to preserve ancient, distinct identities, but they are permeable enough to allow the world's most heavily armed empires to turn those valleys into battlefields.
The geography couldn't keep the empires out.
No, it merely trapped the conflicts inside.
Man, that is incredibly heavy.
It is.
But I do want to pivot us from the darkness of human empires back to the physical landscape itself.
Oh, please do. The ecology is incredible.
It is. Because the very same rugged topography that sheltered those ancient languages from conquering armies also sheltered plants and animals from what was arguably the deadliest global threat in planetary history.
Ah, the Pleistocene Ice Age.
Exactly. This is where the ecology of the Caucasus becomes truly miraculous.
It really does. Today, the region is recognized globally as one of 34 major biodiversity hotspots.
34 in the world.
Yep. It contains roughly 6,400 species of higher plants, and about a quarter of those 1,600 species are completely endemic.
Meaning they aren't found anywhere else.
Literally nowhere else on planet Earth. You have predators like the Persian leopard and the brown bear roaming alongside incredibly hyper-specific invertebrates. I mean, there are over 70 distinct species of forest snails that exist only in these specific mountain pockets.
Okay, 70 different kinds of snails just living out their isolated existence in the mountains is amazing.
It's extremely niche.
Right. But the mechanics of why they are there takes us right back to that salamander from the beginning of our deep dive. The Caucasus operated as a massive ice age refugium.
Right. And if we connect this to the broader mechanics of planetary climate, an ice age refugium acts as a geographic lifeboat.
A lifeboat?
Yeah. Hundreds of thousands of years ago, immense glacial ice sheets swept down across the northern hemisphere. The deep freeze essentially sterilized massive swaths of Europe and Asia, just completely wiping out ancient forests and the animals that relied on them.
But the Caucasus survived.
It did.
Which, okay, how does a mountain range survive a global deep freeze? You would think the elevation would make it even colder, right?
Yeah, you would think so. But it all comes down to the microclimates created by the layout of the vault.
Oh, right, the two C's.
Exactly. The towering Greater Caucasus Range acted as a massive physical shield, basically blocking the freezing Arctic winds coming down from the northern steppes. Simultaneously, you have the Black Sea to the west and the Caspian Sea to the east.
Which act like giant thermal batteries.
Spot on. They trapped heat and constantly fed warm, humid air up into the sheltered, deep valleys of the mountains.
So while the rest of the Eurasian continent was turned into this barren, frozen wasteland, these specific valleys stayed warm enough and wet enough to keep their ecosystems alive.
Exactly.
It's like the forest basically pulled a blanket over its head and waited out the apocalypse.
That is a perfect analogy. It served as the largest forest refugium in the entire Western Asian region. And because of that thermal lifeboat effect, the plants and animals we find in the Caucasus today are largely what biologists call relic species.
Relic species? It sounds a bit haunting, actually.
It is a little haunting. A relic species is essentially a living ghost.
Wow.
Yeah. It is an organism that was once widespread across a massive geographic area in an earlier geologic epoch. But now, it only survives in one isolated fragment because the rest of its habitat was destroyed.
Oh, so they used to be everywhere.
Right. So when you look at the Caucasian parsley frog, the Caucasian grouse, or that salamander we mentioned, You are looking at the survivors of a vanished world.
That is wild.
There are even plant groups in the Caucasus whose closest living genetic relatives are thousands of miles away in Eastern Asia or North America, entirely because the intermediate populations were just completely annihilated by the ice.
That is just incredible to think about. You aren't just walking through a beautiful forest. You are walking through a literal prehistoric time capsule. Right. The mountains held back the ice just like they held back the homogenization of languages.
They did. And that perfectly encapsulates the dual identity of the Caucasus. Well, it is a geographic vault of immense preservation, guarding the fossils of our 1.8 million-year-old ancestors, sheltering indigenous languages, and keeping an ice age ecology alive.
Yeah.
But that exact same vault, because of its strategic location, is also a place of immense geopolitical pressure and historical sorrow.
It really is. Which brings us full circle to our mission today.
Right.
We set out to explore how this massive natural wall between the Black and Caspian Seas shaped the destiny of Eurasia. We've seen how its towering, snow-shimmering peaks gave birth to ancient myths of gods chained to rocks and giant one-eyed shepherds.
The feedback loop of mythology.
Yes. We trace the physical mechanics of its valleys, funneling early hominins out of Africa and trapping modern languages in an acoustic foam of isolation.
Beautifully preserved.
And we examine the brutal geopolitical calculus that turned these lifeboats into choke points for Roman, Persian, Russian, and Soviet empires. And then finally, we uncovered its hidden role as an ecological fortress that literally defied a global deep freeze.
It is a region where history doesn't just happen, you know. It accumulates.
It really does accumulate. So the next time you, the listener, see the Caucasus mentioned in the news, whether you're reading about a modern geopolitical dispute, looking at the shifting energy markets of the Caspian Sea, or watching a winter sporting event held on the slopes near Mount Elbrus, you will know exactly what you are looking at.
You'll see the whole picture.
Right. You aren't just looking at a border on a map. You are looking at a living, breathing museum of human and natural history.
I love that. And, you know, I think there is one final profound takeaway for us to consider, drawing right back to our early conversation about Mount Kaf.
Oh, the Persian myth.
Right. In Persian mythology, the peaks of the Caucasus were believed to surround the entire known world. For ancient people, looking up at that sheer, impenetrable wall of rock and ice, they decided, this is it. Nothing exists beyond this point.
It was the literal edge of reality for them.
Exactly. And I think it challenges us to look at our own lives and ask a difficult question.
Which is,
what are the modern mountains in our world, whether they are physical borders, algorithmic echo chambers, or deep-seated cultural assumptions, that we unconsciously treat as the absolute boundary of our reality? What incredible complex realities might be surviving just on the other side of your personal Mount Kaf?